Today is Monday, and it is the 7th of June, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today. We're going to start out with the weather and what's going on around Siouxland weather-wise. Then we'll go to stories of local interest on the front page, and followed by state, local, and national stories throughout the paper for the rest of the hour. So let's get started. Today is going to be warm, high of 91, partly sunny and hot. Tonight, low of 69 with some wind. Tuesday, hot with sunshine and patchy clouds, high of 90, low of 69. On Wednesday, hot with times of clouds and sun, high of 93, low of 70. Thursday, hot with strong thunderstorms at night, high of 97 on Thursday. And Friday, it'll be clearing with a high of 90. Looks like a warm week ahead, so just be careful out there and take cover if you need to out of the sun. All right, we're going to go to the mini editorial. Today's mini is brought to us by the Sioux City Journal editorial board. For the first time since 2006, the NBA Western Conference Finals will not include the Spurs, the Warriors, or the Lakers. It's refreshing to see some different teams out west compete for a spot in the NBA Finals. This is the opinion of the Sioux City Journal editorial board. So what's happening on the front page? Well, today there is a lovely picture of Bernie Scolaro, a counselor at West High School, smiles while greeting co-workers during a staff breakfast and awards ceremony at Sioux City West. Scolaro, who retired at the end of this school year, was named Counselor of the Year by the Iowa Association for College Admission Counseling. And the title of the story is Little Moments Loom Large. West High Counselor Receives State Award. West High Counselor Bernie Scolaro has learned to appreciate the little moments in life. School counselors may not see a student for years, but when you hear someone say thank you for that piece of advice, that word of encouragement, or that hug meant something, it really touches you, she said. Scolaro has had many little moments during her 21 years at West High School. This is in addition to the previous 8 years she spent counseling students at Bishop Heelan Catholic High School. It's one of the reasons she's been named the Iowa Association for College Admission Counseling Counselor of the Year. Bernie has tirelessly advocated for all students, especially students who may be disadvantaged or first-generation students, her colleagues wrote while nominating her. She's never afraid to promote, advocate for students, and do whatever it takes to advance K-12 education. Specifically, Scolaro was lauded for taking the lead in planning the annual Tri-State College Fair, which supports college choice opportunities for students from Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Not a bad way to end a career, she said, after she and other retirees were honored during a special staff breakfast held at West High on June 2nd. Earning her bachelor's degree from Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York, and a master's degree in counseling, guidance, and personnel from South Dakota State in Brookings, Scolaro said that she will share her honors, and I'm going to move to the next page here, with her West High counseling team. When asked if school counselors get the appreciation they deserve, Scolaro shook her head no. I think everybody who works in education isn't getting enough recognition. It doesn't matter if you're a counselor, a teacher, a bus driver, or part of our custodial staff. We're all working on behalf of the kids. While working as a school counselor, Scolaro has also coached tennis and served as the military coordinator at West. In addition, she helped to implement College Decision Day in the Sioux City Community School District. This is a day that recognizes students who have committed to attending colleges, universities, and trade schools. Although I always hope to make an impact on helping students to be their best versions of themselves, whether that is helping them with college choices, recommendations, financial aid, or social emotional concerns, They have truly made an impact on me and have helped me become the best version of myself. So what's next for her? I'm going to Disney World, she said with a laugh. Isn't that what you're supposed to say after reaching a milestone? In reality, Scolaro said her more immediate plan is to visit her dad back in New York. My dad is 92 and I haven't seen him since the start of COVID pandemic. Once I do that, I'll figure out what to do with the rest of my life. Well, congratulations to her. In other front page news, we will talk about Warrior Developer requesting changes. Sioux City Council to be asked to amend agreements. The Sioux City Council will be asked on Monday to amend development and minimum assessment agreements for the redevelopment of the newly renovated Warrior Hotel and Davidson Building. The Warrior Hotel Limited Partnership wants the council to authorize the execution of a third amendment to the development agreement, a first amendment to the minimum assessment agreement, as well as a substituted promissory note. According to city documents, the proposed resolution and amendments are being requested because the impact of COVID-19 and increased costs of construction that have resulted in a financial deficit for the project. In late February, the developer was initially seeking to divert $1 million in funds set aside for a skywalk extension, but the council ultimately voted to delegate the item from its agenda at the developer's request. Under the terms of the proposed amendments, the minimum assessed value for the development property in the amount of not less than $15 million would be delayed from January 2020 to January of 2021, according to the documents. The property tax rebate grant payments would also be delayed 1 year, with the first rebate payment commencing on November 1st of 2022. The proposed substituted promissory note in the amount of $2.7 million would require interest-only payments in the amount of $177,000 beginning on July 1st of this year through July 1st of 2023. On July 1st, 2023, interest and principal payments would begin. The term of the note would be extended 2 years until January of 2043. The requirements for full-time employees would also be adjusted, with the developer employing 50 full-time employees by July 1st of 2021. The developer or its affiliates would employ 72 full-time employees and maintain them through the termination date of the development agreement on December 31, 2041. The Warrior sat vacant for more than 3 decades before Lou Weinberg partnered with Restoration St. Louis to redevelop the 200,000 square feet of combined space in the Warrior and the Davidson Building into a 148-room Marriott Autograph Hotel and 22 luxury apartments. The renovation project, which began in February of 2019, started out with an estimated cost of $56 million based on preliminary drawings, but that figure rose to $73 million, largely due to construction cost inflation. The Iowa Economic Development Authority awarded the project more than $11 million in historic preservation tax credits, and the council agreed to guarantee $16 million for it. There's a picture of the Warrior Hotel shown at the corner of 6th and Nebraska. After sitting empty since the 70s, the Warrior welcomed its first guest in modern times in September. In other front page news, we have, there is another local story. Oh, not local. Selective service requirement for women. SEPCO may review men-only draft law. The Supreme Court is being asked to decide whether it is sex discrimination for the government to require only men to register for the draft when they turn 18. The question of whether it's unconstitutional to require men but not women to register could be viewed as one with little practical impact. The last time there was a draft was during the Vietnam War, and the military has been all volunteer since. But the registration requirement is one of the few remaining places where federal law treats men and women differently. And women groups are among those arguing that allowing it to stand is harmful. The justices could decide as soon as Monday whether they will hear a case involving the Military Selective Service Act, which requires men to register for the draft. Rhea Tabaka Mar, the director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Women's Rights Project, is urging the court to take up the issue, saying requiring men to register imposes a serious burden on men that's not being imposed on women. Men who do not register can lose eligibility for student loans and civil service jobs, and failing to register is also a felony, punishable up to $250,000 and 5 years in prison. The male-only requirement does more than that. It's sending a tremendously harmful message that women are less fit than men to serve their country in this particular way, and conversely, that men are less fit than women to stay home as caregivers in the event of an armed conflict. We think both of those stereotypes demean men and women. Even if a draft is never used again, retaining the men-only requirement sends a damaging message. A group of retired senior military officers and the National Organization for Women Foundation are among the others urging the court to take the case. If the court agrees to hear the case, it wouldn't be deciding whether women have to register, just whether the current system is constitutional. If it isn't, then it would be up to Congress to decide how to respond, either by passing a law requiring everyone to register or deciding registration is no longer necessary. The issue of who has to register for the draft has been to the court before. In 1981, the court voted 6-3 to uphold the men-only registration requirement. At the time, the decision was something of an outlier because the court was regularly invalidating gender-based distinctions in cases about other areas of the law. Many of those cases were brought by the founding director of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who became a justice in 1993. The last time the High Court considered the Military Selective Service Act, then Justice William Rehnquist explained the purpose of registration was to prepare for a draft of combat troops. He said that because women could not serve in combat, the law was not unlawful sex discrimination that violated the Constitution. But military policy has changed. In 2013, the Department of Defense lifted the ban on women serving in combat. 2 years later, all military roles would be open to women without exception. Just last year, a congressional commission concluded that the time is right to extend the obligation to register to women. The current disparate treatment of women unacceptably excludes from a fundamental civic obligation and reinforces gender stereotypes about the role of women, undermining national security, the commission said in a report. The Biden administration is urging the justices not to take the case and to let Congress instead tackle the issue. Administration lawyers wrote in a brief that the reconsideration of the constitutionality of the male-only registration would be premature at this time, because Congress is actively considering the issue. The Selective Service System, the agency that oversees registration, said in a comment that it doesn't comment on pending litigation, but that it's capable of performing whatever mission Congress should mandate. Okay, so let's go back to our headline, which is Democrats' election bill future in doubt. In Washington, D.C., a key Democratic senator says he will not vote for the largest overhaul of the U.S. election law in at least a generation, leaving no plausible path forward for legislation that his party and the White House have portrayed as crucial for protecting access to the ballot. Voting in election reform that is done in a partisan manner will all but ensure partisan divisions continue to deepen, said Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He wrote that failure to bring together both parties on voting legislation would risk further dividing and destroying the republic we swore to protect and defend as public officials. The bill would restrict partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts, strike down hurdles to voting, and bring transparency to a murky campaign finance system. Among dozens of other provisions, it would require states to offer 15 days of early voting and allow no excuse absentee balloting. Democrats have pushed the legislation as an antidote to a wave of restrictive state voting laws sweeping the country, many inspired by former President Donald Trump's false claims of fraud in his 2020 election loss. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has pledged to bring the election bill to a vote the week of June 21st, testing where senators stand. But without Manchin's support, the bill has no chance of advancing. Republicans are united against it. In appearances on two Sunday shows, Manchin stressed his reasons for opposing the bill, including his view that it's too broad. "I think it's the wrong piece of legislation to bring our country and unite our country, and I'm not supporting that because I think it would further divide us." And if they think they're going to win by subverting and opposing people from voting, they're going to lose, I assure you. Manchin said lawmakers should instead focus their energy on revitalizing the landmark Voting Rights Act, which was weakened by the Supreme Court decision in 2013. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska has joined him in calling for that approach. Manchin's opposition to the broader elections bill is just the latest challenge facing Democrats as they debate how to deliver their promises to voters. Manchin reiterated he would not vote, weaken or eliminate the filibuster, a route that many Democrats see as the only realistic path forward. The filibuster rule requires 60 votes to pass most bills, and in today's Senate, which is split 50-50, that means many of the Democrats' biggest priorities, from voting rights to gun control, are dead on arrival. Manchin and Sinema from Arizona have frustrated their party by their defense of the filibuster, but they aren't alone, with as many as 10 Democratic senators also reluctant to change the laws. President Joe Biden this week used the 100th anniversary of Tulsa's race massacre to make a plea for legislation to protect the right to vote, which comes as Republican-led administrations in Texas and other states pass newer restrictions to make it tougher to cast ballots. Biden said the right to vote was precious and must be protected, and pledged that June would be a month of action on Capitol Hill. "We're not giving up. I'm going to fight like heck with every tool at my disposal for its passage." Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has promised to block the elections bill, which he characterizes as undue government overreach into state election systems. He said no GOP senators support it. All right. We're going to go back now to make sure we've covered all of our front page news. And if so, we will move on. In a local brief, Sioux City Police Department is seeking a suspect in Saturday night shooting. A Sioux City man is considered armed and dangerous and is being sought by law enforcement after a Saturday night shooting at a West Side apartment complex. Around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday, police officers of Sioux City were dispatched to the Hearthstone Apartments in the 2300 block of West 19th Street for a reported shooting. Officers found a man suffering multiple gunshot wounds to the lower part of his body. The man, whose identity has not been released, was taken to a local hospital where he was treated and released a short time later. Police identified the shooter as 22-year-old Corey Deontay Smith of Sioux City. Smith is considered armed and dangerous, according to the press release. An investigation is ongoing. The Missouri River is expected to see lower flows this year. In Norfolk, Nebraska, 2 years after the Missouri River flooding ravaged parts of Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, officials are now dealing with what's shaping up to be one of the river's driest years. Significantly less water is expected to flow into the river this year because conditions remain so dry and snowpack is below normal levels. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said Thursday that its forecast from last month has not changed. The Corps estimated Thursday that 17.9 million acre-feet of water will flow into the river this year. That's about 69% of the average of 25.8 million acre-feet, which would make this year the 22nd driest in the Upper Basin since 1898. Currently, the amount of water being released from the Gavin's Point Dam on the Nebraska-South Dakota border is around 29,500 cubic feet per second and is expected to be 30,000 cubic feet by July 1st. But if runoff remains low, the Corps said it would release would be lowered about 1,000 cubic feet per second below the full level service for the second half of the season. The Energy Secretary in Washington, Jennifer Granholm, said on Sunday she called for more public-private cooperation on cyber defenses and said the U.S. adversaries already are capable of using cyber intrusions to shut down the U.S. power grid. "I think that there are very malign actors who are trying, even as we speak. There are thousands of attacks on all aspects of the energy sector and the private sector generally." Granholm noted, without mentioning the company by name, that Colonial Pipeline was hit in May with a crippling cyber attack by a ransomware company. Colonial temporarily shut down its gasoline distribution networks in the South before paying $4.4 million to the hackers. She urged energy companies to resist paying ransom. "The bottom line is, people, whether you're private or public sector, whatever, you shouldn't be paying ransomware attacks because it only encourages the bad guys." Granholm even spoke in favor of having a law that would ban paying such ransom, though she said, "I don't know whether Congress or the president is, I don't know where they are on that point." Asked whether American adversaries have the capability now of shutting down the U.S. grid, she said, "Yes, they do." There's a lovely picture of our Vice President Kamala Harris gesturing toward members of the media after exiting Air Force Two when a technical problem required the plane to return to Air Force Air Base in Maryland. Harris on a mission in Latin America. With Kamala Harris visiting Guatemala and Mexico on her first foreign trip as VP, the Biden administration is expected to announce new measures to fight smuggling and trafficking and hopes to announce additional anti-corruption efforts as well, a senior administration official said Sunday. Harris has been tasked by President Joe Biden with addressing the root causes of the spike in migration to the U.S.-Mexico border. Corruption, which the administration sees as directly related to the increased migration, is expected to be a central focus of her meetings with Guatemalan president and Mexico's president on Monday and Tuesday. The official who briefed reporters traveling with Harris on Sunday spoke on condition of anonymity. No further details were provided. The trip got off to a rocky start when Harris's plane returned to the Joint Base Andrews in Maryland about 30 minutes after takeoff, because of what her spokesperson said was a problem with the landing gear. She departed on another plane about an hour and a half later. Harris is seeking to secure commitments from Guatemala and Mexico for greater cooperation on border security and economic investment. But corruption in the region is far more intractable challenge will complicate her efforts. It's already had a significant impact on her work in Central America. Harris is yet to engage substantively with the leaders of Honduras and El Salvador, who are both embroiled in corruption scandals. And it's an issue that experts say will need to be addressed to make any lasting changes. Corruption is a cancer in the region, said the director of the Atlantic Council, Latin America Center. Addressing corruption is fundamental to creating hope and creating the potential for opportunity. Corruption also affects human rights protections, employment opportunities, the cost of goods, and much more. Jobs will come with investment, and investment comes when there is certainty in the rule of law. Without that, efforts to improve living conditions can only go so far. Harris has laid out an approach centered on creating better opportunities and living conditions in the region through humanitarian and economic aid. She announced plans to send $310 million to provide support for refugees and address food shortages, and recently secured commitments from a dozen companies and organizations to invest in the Northern Triangle countries to promote economic opportunity and job training. Washington won some goodwill through its vaccine diplomacy this past week. Both presidents received calls from Harris on Thursday telling them the U.S. would be sending 500,000 doses and 1 million doses, respectively, of the COVID-19 vaccine. While in Guatemala, Harris also plans to meet with community leaders, innovators, and entrepreneurs. In Mexico, she will speak with female entrepreneurs and hold a roundtable with labor workers. She's underscored the need to address corruption in public remarks and events. In a May meeting with a number of leading voices on Guatemala's justice system, she noted her work as a prosecutor and said that injustice is a root cause of migration. Part of giving people hope is having a specific commitment to rooting out corruption in the region. Harris has also raised the issue during virtual meetings with leaders of both countries, and aides said she'll do it again during their meeting on her trip. During their past conversations, they have discussed areas of mutual interest, improving port security, combating smuggling networks, going after corrupt actors, and the goal of this trip is to turn that talk into action. While the vice president will make announcements concerning new efforts at cooperation and new programs, she's not expected to announce any new aid during her trip. While in Latin America, Harris will also have to navigate the politics of immigration. Congressional Republicans have criticized both Biden and Harris for deciding not to visit the border and contend the administration is ignoring what they say is a crisis there. April was the second busiest month on record for unaccompanied children encountered at the U.S.-Mexico border following March's all-time high. The Border Patrol's total encounters in April were up 3% from March. Conservatives will be watching Harris closely for any missteps, hoping to drag her into further controversy on an issue they see as a political winner. In her efforts to win commitments on corruption from the region's leaders, Harris can point to a number of moves by the Biden administration last week. Okay. So, we are going to move on. Let's see if we have any other. All right. We're now on the third place page. Okay. There is a picture of the oldest male chimp in the U.S. dies at the zoo. Cobby, a male chimpanzee, plays with pumpkins during the San Francisco Zoo's Boo at the Zoo Halloween celebration in October of 2009. The oldest male chimpanzee living in the accredited North American Zoo died Saturday at the San Francisco Zoo and Gardens. He was 63. The chimpanzee named Cobby had been hand-reared performing chimpanzee before he was brought to the San Francisco Zoo in the 60s. Although the zoo said in a news release that the chimpanzee's cause of death had not been determined, the animal had recently been ill, and zoo officials believe old age was a factor. The International Union for Conservation of Nature lists chimpanzees as endangered, and they're considered among the most at-risk primates in Africa due to hunting, habitat loss, and disease. The average life expectancy of chimpanzees living in the wild is 33 years, while it's between 50 and 60 under human care. Kabi was integral in bringing together the San Francisco Zoo's chimpanzee population and acted like the elder of the troop. Kabi was part of the San Francisco. He touched so many lives and people have so many memories of him. He's irreplaceable. We'll all miss seeing his handsome gray beard watching us from the top platform of the yard. In the world of film, the domestic box office is getting back to normal with moderate wins and a sizable second weekend. After its triumphant first weekend, A Quiet Place Part 2 fell 59% at the North American box office, leaving room for a third movie in the Conjuring franchise to take first place. Warner Brothers, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, earned an estimated $24 million, making it the biggest R-rated opening of the pandemic. Paramount's A Quiet Place sequel earned $20 million in ticket sales. You normally don't see two horror movies at the top of the chart, but it was a solid weekend for both. Movie theaters are coming back, and Memorial Day was no flash in the pan. It feels like summer again. So people are going back to the movies. Let's move now to page 4, and we'll see what else is happening. There are no obituaries today, so I will just continue reading on stories of local, state, and national interest. The statue removal is stalled in Virginia. The court to hear arguments for keeping the memorial where it is. In Richmond, Virginia, last June, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam announced a plan to take down the 131-year-old statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The move was met with widespread praise and relief from racial justice activists who had long seen it as a symbol of white supremacy. A year later, the enormous bronze equestrian statue still towers over Traffic Circle on historic Monument Avenue in downtown Richmond, kept in place by two lawsuits filed by people who believe it should stay right where it is. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court of Virginia will hear arguments in the legal challenges. Among the central issues to be decided by the court, is the Commonwealth of Virginia bound by a decision made by state officials more than 130 years ago? Or can the state undo that decision because the public's attitude toward Confederate symbols has changed drastically since then? Attorneys for the plaintiffs will argue that the governor does not have the authority to move the statue, while Attorney General Mark Herring's office will ask the court to uphold a lower court's ruling in favor of the governor. Northam's decision to take down the statue was announced just 10 days after George Floyd's death under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, during a time there were nightly protests over police brutality and racism in cities around the country, including Richmond. Separate lawsuits were filed by a group of residents who own property near the statue and descendants of signatories to an 1890 deed that transferred the statue, pedestal, and land they sit on to the state. In the latter lawsuit, William Gregory argues that the state agreed to faithfully guard and affectionately protect the statue. In other lawsuits, five property owners, including lead plaintiff Helen Marie Taylor, say that the 1889 joint resolution of the Virginia General Assembly accepting the statue and agreeing to maintain it as a monument to Lee is binding on the governor. During a trial in October, the state argued that it cannot be forced to maintain a statue that no longer reflects its values. Richmond Circuit Judge Riley Marchant agreed, finding that enforcing the 19th century deed would violate current public policy. The judge also cited two budget bills approved by the General Assembly last year that repealed the 1889 Act, authorizing the then governor to accept the gift of the monument, and directed the Department of General Services to remove the 13-ton sculpture. The plaintiffs argue that the budget bills were unconstitutional. What the residents are asserting is that the state cannot arbitrarily take away their property rights or remove a historic landmark in violation of the Constitution of Virginia. If the governor finds this assertion staggering, it can only be because he has an unlimited vision of governmental power. The state must comply with its contractual obligations, just like private citizens. Be interesting to watch to see what happens there. Okay. There's a picture of World War II reenactors gather Sunday on Omaha Beach in Normandy to mark the 77th anniversary of the assault of D-Day that helped bring an end to World War II. A small crowd, but big heart. When the sun rises over Omaha Beach, revealing vast stretches of wet sand extending toward distant cliffs, one starts to grasp the immensity of the task faced by Allied soldiers on June 6, 1944, landing on the Nazi-occupied Normandy shore. The 77th anniversary of D-Day was marked Sunday with several events to commemorate the decisive assault that led to the liberation of France and Western Europe from Nazi control, and to honor those who died. These are the men who enabled liberty to regain a foothold on the European continent, and who in the days and weeks that followed lifted the shackles of tyranny, hedgerow by Normandy hedgerow, mile by bloody mile. Britain's ambassador to France, Lord Edward Llewellyn, said at the inauguration of the new British monument to D-Day's heroes. On D-Day, more than 150,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches codenamed Omaha, Utah, Juno, Sword, and Gold, carried by 7,000 boats. This year on June 6, the beaches stood vast and nearly empty as the sun emerged, exactly 77 years since the Dawn invasion. For a second year in a row, anniversary commemorations are marked by virus travel restrictions that prevented veterans or families of fallen soldiers from the U.S., Britain, Canada, and other Allied countries from making the trip to France. Only a few officials were allowed. At the newly built British Normandy Memorial near the village of Vers-sur-Mer, bagpipes played memorial tunes and warplanes zigzagged overhead, trailing red, white, and blue smoke. Socially distanced participants stood in awe at the solemnity and serenity of the site, providing a spectacular and poignant view over Gold Beach and the English Channel. The new monument pays tribute to those under British command who died on D-Day and during the Battle of Normandy. A text carved on the wall writes, "They died so that Europe may be free." Visitors stood to salute the more than 22,000 men and women, mostly British soldiers whose names were etched on its stone columns. Giant screens showed D-Day veterans gathered simultaneously at Britain's National Memorial Arboretum to watch the Normandy event remotely. King Charles expressed regret that he could not attend in person. Prince Charles. On June 6th of 1944, in the heart of the mist that enveloped the Normandy coast, was like a lightning bolt of freedom, French Defense Minister Florence Parly told the ceremony. "France does not forget. France is forever grateful." Charles Shea, a Penobscot Native American who landed as a U.S. Army medic on June 6th of 1944 and now calls Normandy home, was the only surviving D-Day veteran at the Vers-sur-Mer ceremony. Another veteran of the Battle of Normandy, British Captain David Michael Reist, was also present. He landed with his team in Normandy on June 12th to replace officers who had died in the first days of the fight. Shea then took part in this commemoration at the American Cemetery later in the day, on a bluff overseeing Omaha Beach, in the presence of officials from the U.S., Canada, Britain, Germany, and other allied countries. In the Vatican City, Pope Francis on Sunday expressed his pain over the discovery in Canada of the remains of 215 Indigenous students of church-run residential schools, and pressed religious and political authorities to shed light on this sad affair. He did not offer the apology sought by the Canadian Prime Minister. Pope Francis, in remarks to faithful gathering in St. Peter's Square, also called on the authorities to foster healing, but made no reference to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's insistence 2 days earlier that the Vatican apologize and take responsibility. From the 19th century until the 1970s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend state-funded Christian schools, a majority of them run by Roman Catholic missionary congregations, in a campaign to assimilate them into Canadian society. The Canadian government has admitted that physical and sexual abuse were rampant in the schools, with students beaten for speaking their native languages. Ground-penetrating radar was used to confirm the remains of the children at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in Kamloops, British Columbia, last month. The school was Canada's largest such facility and was operated by the Catholic Church between 1890 and 1969. I am following with pain the news that arrives from Canada about the upsetting discovery of 215 children's remains, said Pope Francis in his customary Sunday noon remarks to the public. I join with the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. Trudeau on Friday blasted the church for being silent and not stepping up and called on it to formally apologize and make amends for its prominent role in his nation's former system of church-run Indigenous residential schools. He noted that when he met with Pope Francis at the Vatican in 2017, he had asked him to move forward on apologizing and on making records available. But Trudeau said, we are still seeking resistance from the church, possibly from the church in Canada. All right, we're going to move on now. There's a whole page about learning how to play poker. I think we're going to skip that for now. We're going to move on to movies and Just Judy. Judy Garland looms large in the history of movies, although she flourished on screen for only a decade. She arrived with a movie-stealing cameo in Broadway Melody of 1938, and she's terrific in Love Finds Andy Hardy, but it's The Wizard of Oz in 1939 that ensured her place in cinematic history. Garland would go on to make 20 features in the next decade, culminating with The Good Old Summertime. But due to behavior resulting from drug use that studio executives hooked her on, she was persona non grata in Hollywood by then. She lived another 20 years but completed only 7 more movies. Garland's filmography seems larger because she was so prolific in the 40s and became a star so young. All chronology is skewed for Garland, whose death at age 47 in 1969 seemed to consign her to a previous era of movie history, even though if she were alive today, she'd be a bit younger than Betty White. Renee Zellweger's Oscar-winning performance in 2019's Judy captures 2 ways to look at Garland's legacy. It's a tragedy because she was in such bad shape at a young age that we'll never know how many opportunities she missed. The flip side is that her decade at the top of one of the best in movie history. There's a series of musical all-timers best remembered for her iconic songs On the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe, The Harvey Girls, Get Happy, Summer Stock, I've Got Rhythm, and Girl Crazy. There were also dramas and comedies that showcased the indelible timing that would dazzle audience when she turned to the concert stage. And even in the last couple decades of her life, the Grand Rapids, Minnesota native, whose story was told in the Judy Garland Museum there, achieved a couple of excellent film performances. The Wizard of Oz. Garland's training in the studio system did help her achieve greatness in her first starring role. Actually, she achieved it within minutes of the start in Over the Rainbow, the signature song that meant many things over the course of her career. A Star is Born in 1954, after her 40s run, Garland would just make three more musicals, this being the undisputed best, and surprisingly, it's her first competitive Oscar nomination. Garland had already lived through enough Hollywood angst to know in her bones this story of one career on its way up and another on the way down. Meet Me in St. Louis in 1944. It's tough to pick the best number of this jam-packed musical. Is it the trolley song or Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas? In The Good Old Summertime in 1949, we meet Garland's Veronica. She's wearing a hat with fake birds on it and attracts the attention of Van Johnson, her co-star, who monkeys around with birds and suddenly turns out to be actual birds. The Clock, nobody understood Garland's appeal better than Vincent Minnelli, who directed her several times, married her, and fathered daughter Liza Minnelli. He showcased Garland's humor and vulnerability in her first big non-singing role as a quirky woman who meets and marries a soldier on leave. And in 1946, The Harvey Girls, the story of girls who helped settle the American West, is extremely old-fashioned, but it's still fun to see Garland reunited with Oz co-star Ray Bolger. So, lots of interesting trivia about Judy Garland's life. She would have been 99 on June 10th of this year. All right, we're going to move now back to news. Let's see. No mass protests after Honolulu police kill a black man. In Honolulu, Lindsay Maini and her South African husband moved to Hawaii, where she grew up, believing it would be safer to raise their two black children here than in any other U.S. state. 3 months after they arrived, Honolulu police shot and killed her husband, 29-year-old Lindani Miani, who was black. "We never thought anything like this would ever happen here," said Lindsay Miani, who is white. To some, Lindini Miani's death and the muted reaction from residents is a reminder that Hawaii is not the racially harmonious paradise it's held up to be. The couple moved to Honolulu from predominantly white Denver in January. Hawaii, where white people are not the majority and many people identify as having multiple ethnicities, felt right. "We were refreshed to be back to somewhere that's so diverse." Of Hawaii's $1.5 million residents, only 3.6% are black. Yet in Honolulu alone, black people made up more than 7% of the police who used force against, according to the police data in 2019. There have been some local gatherings and small protests decrying Miani's death, but it has not inspired the passionate outrage seen elsewhere in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. Miani's death would have generated mass protests in any other city. "When you're told you live in paradise and you point out that it's not paradise for people of color, that makes people uncomfortable." One reason for lack of outrage is that police have limited details of what happened. It's being revealed is what they want us to see. According to police's account of the fatal shooting, Miani entered a home that wasn't his, sat down, and took off his shoes, prompting a frightened occupant to call 911. Outside the house, he ignored commands to get on the ground and physically attacked officers, leaving one with a concussion. Police released two brief clips from body camera footage, but it was difficult to make out what was happening in the dark. Three shots rung out, and a police officer exclaims, "Police." A wrongful death lawsuit Lindsay Mayani filed against Honolulu alleges police are motivated by racial discrimination toward people of Mr. Mayani's African descent. Simply by being black, he was seen as an immediate threat that the Asian woman who called 911 needed to be protected from. Now retired police chief Susan Ballard, who is white, said at the time, officers reacted to Mayani's behavior, not his race. This person seriously injured the officers and their lives were in jeopardy. Mayani's widow thinks he mistook the home for a Hare Krishna temple next door. Early in the day, the family had visited culturally significant places as they drove to Oahu's North Shore. At one point, the couple prayed together, she recalled, because something fell off. He seemed stressed. Because of that, she thinks her husband, who was Christian and connected to his Zulu culture, was seeking out a spiritual place in his new neighborhood. Shortly before the shooting, she spoke to him by phone. He was on his way home, some five blocks away. She believes her race has contributed to a waning of shock sentiment over his death. White people don't come from Hawaii stereotypically. Black people don't come from Hawaii stereotypically. So even though I'm three generations of being there and you look at my skin, you say, oh, must be a holy, said using the Hawaiian word for foreigner. But Mayani was indeed a newcomer to Hawaii, which might have contributed to the general reaction to his death. All right, in other news, we're going to go on to the world of sports, since a couple headlines in the paper today as it regards to sports. The Falcons trade Julio Jones to the Titans. Falcons wide receiver Julio Jones, a seven-time Pro Bowler, ranks first in NFL history in averaging 95 receiving yards per game through 135 games. And the Tennessee Titans have been talking to the Falcons about seven-time Pro Bowler wide receiver Julio Jones for nearly 3 weeks. In the end, they pried Jones loose with a couple of draft picks, and the highest being a second rounder. So Julio Jones will now be a Tennessee Titan. In professional baseball, the Minnesota Twins turn a triple play and top the Kansas City Royals 2-1. In other news, Patrick Cantlay wins a playoff at the Memorial Golf Tournament on Sunday without John Rahm. The emotion and intensity felt the same to Patrick Cantlay, whether it was his clutch 25-foot putt to tie for the lead or his 12-foot par putt in a playoff that made him a winner. The handshake with Jack Nicklaus, as special as it was 2 years ago. That was as far as normalcy was allowed to go at a tournament that was as much about the guy who won as the guy who didn't play. Plenty of drama and a little rain. And no sign of John Rahm. Some 24 hours earlier, Rahm pulled away with a 64 to build a six-shot lead. Patrick Cantlay already was figuring out how low he would need to have to score to get a chance. And then Rahm was told on the 18th green Saturday evening that his COVID-19 test came back positive and knocked him out of the tournament. I would have much rather faced him down today and shot an extremely low round and beat him that way. But unfortunately, there's nothing I could do. I did everything I could with the cards I was dealt, and I did a really good job focusing on the task at hand and staying present. It's all you can do in this game. The tour said Rahm had been in contact with a COVID-19 positive and was in its contact tracing program, subjected to tests every day since Monday. Every test was negative until Saturday after his rain-delayed second round. He was informed after tying the 54-hole record at 18-under, 198. His six-shot lead tied the Memorial record set by Tiger Woods. And then he was out of the tournament. "We were all devastated," said Jack Nicklaus. "I wish we could figure out how to give John three-fourths of the trophy." But that's how it goes. In other news, on local news, Sam Prue stared down other players of all ages and prevailed in the 87th Interstate Amateur at Two Rivers Golf Club on Sunday. And good, the 61-year-old outlasted 25-year-old Connor Power in a sudden-death play hole that ended on the third extra hole. Congratulations to him. That's it for our news today. All of a sudden, our hour went quickly. So just to recap, it's going to be a hot, hot week. So please be careful when you're outside. Be careful. Today is going to be 91, Tuesday high of 90, Wednesday 93, and Thursday 97. So take care. Enjoy your week. And thank you to the Sioux City Journal and to the Iowa Reading Radio Network for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. Thank you.